claims that law must be colorblind, or that the datum of race is no longer relevant to public policy, must be seen as aspiration rather than as descriptive of reality.
It has been 25 years since Justice Powell first suggested approval of the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of higher education. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today.
Hello, and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast, where we talk about how the decisions of the Supreme Court and the words of the Constitution play out behind the schoolhouse gate. I'm Elise Spenner. Hannah is out with the flu today, so she will not be joining us for our extra special interview, but the episode today is still going to be great. I'm talking with Richard Thompson Ford to zoom out from our discussion of specific affirmative action cases and policies to discuss how affirmative action has become deeply woven into our social and cultural debates around race and the continuing effects of discrimination on our society. Before we get started, let me explain just how awesome Professor Richard Ford is. Currently, he's the George E. Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford Law School. He's also a regular contributor at Slate and has written for various national publications. In addition to litigating and teaching, Professor Ford was a housing policy consultant for Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a commissioner of the San Francisco Housing Authority. He now examines both the social and legal implications of racial segregation, discrimination claims, and civil rights. Finally, oh my goodness, he has written three recent books, Universal Rights Down to Earth, Rights Gone Wrong, How Law Corrupts the Struggle for Equality, and Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. So let's not waste any more time. Here's my conversation with Professor Ford. Professor Ford, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
Of course. So our first question, which we always like to ask our guests, is what were you like as a high school student?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I guess as a high school student, I can't say I was one of the popular kids. I had a great group of friends. We were more edgy and we were really into what would now be described as punk or new wave music, a little bit of hip hop. And I played in the band, I played alto saxophone, I worked on the school newspaper. So that was my crew in high school.
That's awesome. I am an editor of my school newspaper, and my big team at school is our newspaper staff. So it's great to know that you had that as well.
High school journalism is a great time and a great group of people that usually does it. My son is a high school journalist too, or was. He just started college.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic way to know more about your school and about your community and feel like you're a part of a group of people. So I really enjoy it. But how did you find yourself wanting to pursue law?
Well, I, in college, studied political science and philosophy, and I took a couple classes at the law school at Stanford as an undergraduate and really loved those classes. I found it fascinating. And one of the TAs in one of the classes was a student at Stanford Law School who encouraged me to apply broadly to law schools and thought I'd be a good fit. And so I did that. And I was admitted to a number of great law schools. I went to Harvard. And so that started my legal trajectory.
And what has gotten you particularly interested in the topics of, you know, racial segregation, discrimination, civil rights? Obviously, broadly, political science and law are super intertangled. But what are you specifically interested in this issue?
Well, you know, when I went to law school, I wanted to do one of two things. I wanted to be an entertainment lawyer or a civil rights lawyer. And it turned out I didn't wind up being either of those, but the interest still carried through. I practiced law for a few years at a typical kind of large law firm in San Francisco, but I always retained my interest in these other areas, particularly racial justice. I did some work on affordable housing with the city of Cambridge when I was a law student. And one of the things that became very clear to me was the interrelationship of questions of poverty and of racial segregation in cities and larger issues of race relations, that they were all intimately intertwined. So some of my first academic work focused on the connections between racial segregation, lack of opportunities, and the way local governments are organized. And so those have always been a concern of mine. I actually didn't get started in the more specific anti-discrimination, as opposed to these larger issues of housing, the specific things specific to race discrimination until later, but they were always related to the work that I was doing in questions of housing segregation.
How did you personally, throughout your time in education and even after, kind of observe the impacts of poverty and structural inequities on what you were seeing in your education and obviously during your time in the city of Cambridge? What did you observe and how did you internalize that, if that makes sense?
Sure. Well, part of it, obviously, you observe some things just through daily experience, the segregation of neighborhoods. This was true in the Bay Area where I went to college. It was true in Cambridge and the Boston area. It's true all over the United States. And those observations are, they're troubling and personally painful for me as a Black man to observe that and to observe the way that people living in impoverished neighborhoods that don't have a shot in many circumstances for a decent life, that they're starting off with two strikes against them. And so there's that. Now, another thing I noticed and experienced was the big divergence between people of color living in those neighborhoods with high crime rates and lack of job opportunities and, you know, just really kind of a bad dead-end cycle. And on the other hand, people who had opportunities for a variety of reasons. And I was fortunate. My parents were educators and they put a strong emphasis on education and they provided a good middle-class upbringing and resources to succeed. And a lot of kids don't get those advantages. So moving forward, I think there's a huge gap between these potential trajectories. And one of the promises of the civil rights movement was to close that gap so that everybody, or at least a much larger group of people, would have those kinds of opportunities.
As you began to observe that education was this critical barrier between people with and without opportunities, how did that channel into your research around anti-discrimination and how we use education as a tool for social mobility?
Yes, well, a lot of my work focused on kind of the lost promise or the failures of civil rights legislation. I think growing up, I had the narrative in mind that we had passed the Civil Rights Act, we'd had cases like Brown versus Board of Education, society's moving forward in the right direction. Yes, there's still some racism, but we're moving rapidly in the right direction. Soon, these racial issues are going to be a thing of the past. It didn't turn out that way, or it hasn't turned out that way yet. And that experience led me to want to look at why the civil rights movement had run into obstacles and what we could do to overcome them. One of the biggest impediments involved lack of opportunities for things like a good quality education. And I was struck by how, starting at the K through 12 level, neighborhood schools varied dramatically in terms of the type of education you had access to based on their location. And because of the segregation of neighborhoods, that was going to have huge racial effects. In addition, even in schools like the ones I went to that had resources and were, you know, solid middle class schools, there were still racial barriers. They were more subtle, but there's no doubt that there were people who were racist. And some of those people were teachers. And that would affect not only the motivation of students to learn and engage in school, which is critical during those years, but also might just flat out affect your, if the teacher comes in with the attitude that this kid probably isn't that smart or can't excel, that may reflect how they evaluate students, particularly in areas where there's some subjective components to grading, which there often are. And so I could see the continued relevance of race in terms of the opportunities that people had up and down the income spectrum, but although, of course, most dramatically for people at the low end of the economic ladder.
For reference for our listeners, as you were observing that the civil rights movement really hadn't come to fruition in delivering on promises of equity, especially in education, what was the situation in law with affirmative action and integration in trying to increase quality of education and the access to education that students of color had?
Yes, well, that's an important question. So I went to high school in the 1980s, and I went to law school in the 1980s and 1990s. So it was a while ago. One of the things that happened in K through 12 education was that during the period of time when I was in school, school desegregation was working. And so public schools were getting less segregated. I lived in a jurisdiction where there was, I'm not sure whether it was court ordered or whether it was the result of a court settlement, but there was a desegregation plan that meant that the schools made an effort to desegregate. And those kinds of efforts started to fall off in the late 1980s. And now we're in a situation where the public schools in the United States are resegregating. So rather than progress, we're actually going backward with respect to K through 12. Now, affirmative action doesn't play the same type of role in K through 12 education, although there are some circumstances in which selective schools or magnet schools might have used racial preferences until the Supreme Court held that that was unconstitutional in a case called Parents Involved in Community Schools versus Seattle School District, and that was 2007. So now you can't do it there. Affirmative action was still in place in higher education, but of course, we had a series of decisions and ballot initiatives that rolled it back in a variety of ways. So, you know, Bakke in 1979 was the initial restriction. Then you had a series of subsequent affirmative action cases that restricted the capacity of universities to use affirmative action, kind of tightening it up in a variety of ways. But affirmative action, of course, survived. You had Proposition 209 in California, where I'm from, which invalidated affirmative action for public universities and other public institutions in the state. And that made a huge difference. You could see the number of African-American and Latinx students enrolled in particularly the very elite UCs like UCLA and UC Berkeley plummeted after Proposition 209. And it started to tick back up a little bit in recent years, but it was a huge effect. And meanwhile, at private universities, the efforts at racial inclusion have been successful. So the number of African American students or Black students at Stanford now is significantly higher than when I was a student there. And the consequence of that I can see quite clearly is a better educational experience for everybody because you're much more likely to have a representation in classes and discussions. People are more likely to know students of different races. But it's especially pronounced for the students of color who have a sense of community and connection that we just didn't have when I was in college with relatively small numbers.
I think you've got a couple of points I want to talk about. So first, you talk about this idea of diversity and affirmative action, race-conscious policies, as bringing diversity into our schools, and then when we take them away, we lose diversity. It's not like your diversity stays. We're actually resegregating. And in California, where I live as well, the UCs and the CSUs are quickly losing their minority enrollments because of the proposition that they passed. And there was actually a proposition on the ballot a couple of years ago to bring affirmative action back in the workplace, at least it failed, but that's beside the point. But why do we have this misconception that there is a certain point when affirmative action won't be necessary, or that if we achieve, I'm not saying this right, but a decent amount of diversity, then we don't need affirmative action anymore?
Yeah, I think that some of that is just wishful thinking, and it's a type of wishful thinking I understand. I mean, I think at some level, almost everybody would prefer a world in which we didn't have to think about race and we didn't have to think about racism, where racial difference was just a type of ethnic or cultural difference that didn't have much of an effect in terms of people's wealth or life prospects. And the promise of the civil rights movement was that it would get us to that. And one thing that a lot of people thought was that if you can just stop discrimination, then we'll have fixed the problem. Now, that's a nice idea. And it's an idea that hinges on a capacious, a broad enough definition of discrimination that you're actually capturing all the problems. But the legal definition of discrimination doesn't do that. The legal definition of discrimination is quite narrow. And so it only captures things that are pretty obvious cases of discrimination, where there's an express discriminatory motivation that you can prove, or where there's a very large disparity that can't be explained by anything other than race. So you've got all the types of discrimination that I was just talking about don't really get captured in these definitions of discrimination. You come from a low-income neighborhood, the schools weren't so great. That's not race discrimination under the law. You go to a public school and maybe some of the teachers were a little racist, but you can't prove it. That doesn't count under the law. And so the idea that, as Chief Justice John Roberts once said, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Well, that sounds nice, but it doesn't capture, and frankly, I think he knows this perfectly well, it doesn't capture the narrowness of the term discrimination as it's applied in the law, and how that doesn't line up with the types of racial disadvantage that still exist in our society. So if you don't do something to continue to address those, yes, you're going to slide back. You're going to regress. And as you point out, we've seen it in K through 12. When you stop the desegregation programs, you don't stand still, you go back. When you stop the affirmative action programs, you don't stay at status quo, you slide back.
I want to, maybe I'm going backwards a little bit, but talk about affirmative action and how we rationalize race conscious policies in law and the different ways that we rationalize it. So we talked about on our podcast, the diversity rationale. And we've talked about, as well, the reparations-based principle that remedying past discrimination. Explain to me how you view these different methods of legitimizing affirmative action under the Constitution and how we should kind of delineate between them.
Yeah, that's an important question. And so under the law, if we're just talking about higher education, after Bakke, for all practical purposes, the only rationale that's acceptable is diversity. So now that's a little, I say for all practical purposes, you could parse the language and come up with the potential for others. But practically speaking, the universities need to say we're doing affirmative action in order to promote diversity. And effectively, diversity is pedagogically motivated. It means our classrooms are better because we brought in people of different races. Now, that's a good rationale. It's true. It's a good reason to have affirmative action. I don't think it's the only reason. It's certainly not the only reason that people historically had developed affirmative action policies, but that's the only one that's legally acceptable right now. So we've spent a lot of time talking about diversity, less time talking about some of these other rationales. But back before Bakke, people thought you needed affirmative action in order to make up for past discrimination that might have affected the ability of students to shine in terms of the normal admissions criteria. And so you could just make the plausible supposition that in a society where there's still a fair amount of racism that affects people, that that might have an effect on their other admissions criteria, things like grades and test scores and connections that are going to get you good reference letters and the like. That's a rationale that's plausible, but the universities don't argue. You might think it's important to have affirmative action in order to ensure that you have a diverse set of leaders, that you're training a diverse set of leaders that can serve different communities. Universities used to talk about that. Medical schools used to talk about that. They'd say you need doctors to serve the Black community. For the most part, the doctors, white doctors, aren't doing that. We think we need more Black doctors to go back to those communities. These are good arguments that are not now widely discussed because Bakke said diversity is the only legally permissible rationale. And the big one that they ruled out was this idea that you could be remedying societal discrimination, which I think is an important idea, but one that now is not discussed because it's not a legally acceptable rationale after Bakke.
So obviously we're recording today after the oral arguments. And I think what I heard a lot of in the arguments was that, well, everyone seems to agree that yes, diversity is great. Like, we all want diversity in theory, and it is clear that it helps our classrooms and makes our schools better. There is a constitutional barrier, this is what the conservative justices were arguing, to doing so, and that it's not allowed. But I think I also heard justices kind of talking about how we are okay with socioeconomic diversity, we're okay with geographic diversity, we're okay with, at least to some level, promoting gender diversity, but not race. So explain the sticking point with race when it comes to the Constitution and why other forms of diversity might be more permissible.
Yes, just well, the legal argument that they're referring to is that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment has been interpreted to apply what we call strict scrutiny to racial classification. Now, racial classifications are distinctive in that respect. So classifications based on other things, like, for instance, sex or gender, haven't been held to the strict scrutiny standard. They've been held to a different kind of heightened scrutiny. Sometimes it's called the intermediate scrutiny. Depends on what justice you ask at what year, but not strict. So race gets a higher type of scrutiny, and it has to clear a higher bar in order to be justified. Now, there are good reasons for that. When you look at America's history with respect to racial discrimination of the straightforward Jim Crow variety. And so what some opponents of affirmative action would argue is that the problem in the Jim Crow South was that they were segregating people because of race. The schools in Topeka, Kansas discriminated because of race and assigned Black kids to one school and white kids to the other school. Now, that kind of discrimination is the problem, and it's a problem when UC Berkeley does it or when any other governmental institution does it, regardless of why. And that's the critical question. Should that be a legal principle, regardless of why? And I would argue, and I think, you know, some of the justices on the Supreme Court, maybe not a majority right now, but some of them would agree with me that why matters. That why is everything? That we have an amendment that was passed during Reconstruction in the aftermath of the Civil War in order to ensure that former slaves had an equal shot in this country. And the meaning of that amendment clearly applies to something like Jim Crow segregation in the South in the 1950s. And it clearly doesn't apply to something like an affirmative action policy that's designed to ensure racial representation for precisely those people. It's the opposite, in fact. So one quote was that it confuses a no trespassing sign for a welcome mat. But that's the argument, that race is different than everything else because of this history, but with the strange idea that we can't think about why people are considering race. It's just a formal rule, no consideration of race.
I think we've touched on the legal grounds for affirmative action and the legal arguments against it, but I also want to talk about the cultural and social climate around affirmative action, in that in the oral argument as well, they talked a lot about stigma for students that perhaps people think they were only admitted because of affirmative action. But on the other hand, students that might feel isolated on campus because there aren't as many faces that look like them because there aren't race conscious policies. Or some students, and I know this from being a high schooler, that think that they're not going to have a fair shot at getting into a school because of affirmative action. So talk about how affirmative action has permeated our social and cultural thinking around race and why that's super important to the Supreme Court and everything as well.
Yes, well, it's an interesting question as to how much that should weigh in terms of a legal argument, because one might argue that these kinds of considerations, while relevant, are precisely the kind of things that you ought to leave to university admissions officers who have a better sense of campus climate and all of the pros and cons. And that those, one might also add, that those kind of considerations around stigma arguably apply to any admissions policy that gives any sort of preference. So you have the same set of issues that would attach to children of alumni who everyone understands get preferences, or a lot of other categories. My own view is that the stigma argument is overblown. I don't want to say that it's non-existent. I mean, I do think that there's some degree of racial stigma, and one could make the case that with respect to race, it's particularly problematic because of the history of racial insult and contempt in our society. But I would argue that the overwhelming source of stigma doesn't come from affirmative action. It comes from racial stereotypes. It comes from bad racial attitudes. It comes from a history and legacy of discriminatory attitudes that most people of color have experienced throughout their lives and that need to be overcome. There's great psychological research around this, but none of that research suggests that the cause of feelings of racial inferiority is something like affirmative action. It's quite independent of that. Now, with respect to the other arguments, like the kind of balkanization, that's one of the terms that's sometimes used, where people feel that it's a racial spoils system, or they feel that they're not going to have a fair shot because of affirmative action. Those arguments, again, there's some truth to that, to be sure. One thing that it's worth pointing out, however, is that when you examine the extent to which affirmative action actually affects the chances of any other applicant for admissions, it's negligible. It's just statistically speaking, it has a negligible effect. And so in fact, your chances aren't appreciably worse because of affirmative action. It's just not that significant a program. There's not that many people that it affects. And instead, what opponents do is they conflate how much affirmative action might affect people who don't benefit from it with how much it benefits the people who do benefit from it. And these are two very different questions. So they'll say, well, you know, a Black applicant with the same grades and test scores has a whatever percentage higher chance than a white or Asian applicant. That may be true, but it doesn't follow that getting rid of affirmative action would mean that the white and Asian applicant had the same chance as the Black applicant under affirmative action. That's a statistical confusion. And I would suggest that a lot of the reason people feel that affirmative action is cheating them out of their shot or their spot at Harvard is because of all of the anti-affirmative action rhetoric that's been promoted for years and years. You hear this argument consistently enough that people really have a distorted sense of the effect that affirmative action has on their chances of admission.
No, it was incredibly interesting to listen to the argument and hear some of the justices pressing for, like, give me one specific example of when race has completely flipped the switch on an applicant. Like, they weren't going to be admitted, and now they totally are. And then there was, I think they cited, like, 1.2% for the UNC case where race was some sort of deciding factor in letting an applicant in, which was really a almost negligible percent of applicants. But at least where I go to high school, it's just, and what I hear on social media and in the news, etc., is that I didn't get admitted to the school in, I think it's probably because I'm XYZ race. And that is just very shocking to hear the discrepancy between that and the actual data that we're hearing from the Supreme Court.
Yes, I think that a lot of this, I mean, college admissions are clearly a very fraught time for high school students. People feel that there's a lot riding on it. People feel that they've spent their entire K through 12 educational career building up to this one moment when they're going to get the acceptance or rejection letters from the schools of their choice. And so I can see how those emotions running high would lead people to misinterpret the effect of some policy that they might think affected their chances. And then affirmative action is the only one that's legally actionable. So when you look at everything else that goes into the admissions process, other than grades and test scores, none of those can be challenged. And so we don't have a long conversation about how much legacy admissions or athletic admissions or regional preferences or all the other things that go on in selective universities affected someone's chances. The only thing you focus on is affirmative action. And again, as you say, statistics demonstrate that that's relatively negligible, whereas some of these other things have a pretty large effect on people's chances of admission.
I think I skipped over something you said before, which I think is equally important, in that affirmative action is almost an outlet, not only for our frustrations about not getting into the college of our choice, but also for just general racial animosity and historic discrimination. How do you see affirmative action as kind of this flashpoint or culmination of just a lot of racial tension rather than actually being the source of that or the cause of that discrimination, so to speak?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That affirmative actions kind of become a proxy war for a lot of other struggles around race and racial justice. I think that there is a significant faction in the United States who feels that they're tired of hearing about race and racism, that we had the civil rights struggle, we passed the legislation, we get to be done. And frustration over having to consistently hear about it is affecting this conversation about affirmative action, because here's another example where we're not done yet. We're still going to have this policy involving race, which suggests at some level that our society still has unresolved racial inequities that need to be addressed. So I think there's that. I think the emphasis put on selective education by a much smaller group of Americans is out of proportion to what it should be, quite honestly. I mean, I think selective schools are great and it's wonderful that we get a great education, but people put way too much emphasis on very minor distinctions in perceived prestige. And so a student who is admitted to Duke but wanted to go to Harvard feels like they've taken an enormous hit in their prestige. It's just preposterous. Duke is one of the most elite schools in the world. And the idea that that is going to be a significant effect on their life chances doesn't make much sense. But people are measuring themselves according to that kind of metric. And that also distorts the conversation around affirmative action.
So because there is so much cultural and social turmoil around affirmative action, and there is so much resentment about how we change the racial status quo, what will happen when we move backward and suddenly we don't have affirmative action policies, at least not explicit ones that take race into account? Then what happens to the social debate around race and affirmative action?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. First of all, I expect that the Supreme Court will strike down affirmative action. Just looking at the composition of the court, I'd be very surprised if that didn't happen. Honestly, I don't think that's going to end the issue. I worry that the next round of litigation is going to be complaints that the universities are surreptitiously considering race, and the primary source of evidence for that claim will simply be the numbers. It'll be, your numbers didn't drop enough. So I want us to think for a minute about that lawsuit. You just still have too many Black and Latino people at your university. Therefore, you must be considering race. And so I don't think that this is going to resolve the question. And I think it might move us into yet an even uglier moment in terms of the way we talk about race in this context. I suspect that eliminating affirmative action is going to have a significant effect on the number of underrepresented minorities at selective universities. That's what happened in California. That's what's happened in most places. Now, I would temper that, though, by saying that I think universities have learned something over the years in watching what's happened at other universities. And one thing they've started to acknowledge is that many of the other admissions criterion have what we could describe as a negative or a disparate impact on the underrepresented groups. In other words, why is it that without affirmative action, you're going to have low numbers? Well, it's because your other admissions criterions are screening out the members of underrepresented groups. And those other admission criteria could be reexamined. And I would argue that they should be reexamined, not necessarily abandoned, because there are good reasons, obviously, to consider grades and test scores, but they're a proxy for academic promise. They're not academic promise in and of themselves. And so the question is, how good a proxy are they? And I think the premise of affirmative action is that they're less good as a proxy for academic promise for members of underrepresented groups than they are for members of relatively privileged groups that are well represented. That's a generalization, but I think it's a valid generalization. Now, given that, it may be that the university wants to reconsider using these criteria as a general matter. And one of the things that happened during the pandemic, of course, is that universities have had to suspend their use of some of these criteria because people couldn't take the test. And so we're now undergoing an experiment. Well, what happens to university admissions when a bunch of them go test optional or test blind? How do they recalibrate their admissions? I think the jury is still out on how the universities did with respect to that. But my hope is that university admissions will consider that and consider revising their admissions criterion and examining those that do have a racial impact. And there's nothing in constitutional law that would suggest that the universities can't do that. In fact, the extant legal standard is typically that institutions have some obligation to avoid things that have an unjustified racial impact.
Right. But I think you make a really good point when you talk about what the future of litigation could look like in a post-affirmative action world, in that suddenly what we're asking is, do we have few enough minority students? Which honestly makes me reconsider. Now you start to see the end that the people that are opposed to affirmative action are seeking. Like, can we just say that what they're seeking is to have fewer minority students in our schools? And that seems like a really, really poor reason to not have affirmative action.
Yes. I mean, I think you put that well. I fear that at least some of the opponents of affirmative action, that is precisely their goal.
And then I think the other interesting point you bring up is related to these kind of, I don't want to say disingenuous, but less explicit ways of trying to bring more underrepresented minority students to schools, like using socioeconomic diversity, mm-hmm. or looking at zip codes, which are often strongly right. correlated to race because of housing discrimination. What do you think will happen to those strategies that are trying to reach the end result of bringing more underrepresented mm-hmm. minorities on campus, but aren't doing it just by using race as what some people like say, like a check mark? So what happens to those policies?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that's where the action is in this latest round of anti-affirmative action litigation. The open question is how strong the Supreme Court's opinion will be with respect to those types of measures. So back in all of the earlier rounds of affirmative action litigation, alternatives were seen as the desired approach. In the Texas case, the Texas 10% plan was held up as the shining example of a race-neutral alternative. A few years later, Texas gets challenged in court for using the 10% plan. And so the worry is one possible interpretation of the equal protection standard, one that I certainly disagree with, but one that you could imagine, is to say you can't do something indirectly that you can't do directly. If your reason for doing this is considering race, that's just as unlawful as if you out and out have a racial classification. So I don't know, but I could certainly imagine another round of affirmative action litigation that would press that claim. Then you've got interesting questions about, well, what if you're doing it for a mix of reasons? Socioeconomic diversity is going to increase racial diversity. Are we going to parse the motivations of admissions offices? Well, is the reason you're doing it really socioeconomic diversity, or is it actually secretly race? I hope we don't go in this direction, but I think that some of the people behind this litigation would like to go in that direction.
Yeah, and I think we started to see the justices and the advocates falling down that path of, is race your primary thing you're trying to address with this admission strategy, or is it something else? And if it's more than race, is that okay? And then we even got to the point, I think, where they were talking about, like, an applicant's essays. Can you write about racial experiences in your essays and talk about how you were discriminated on the basis of race, or how to struggle because you moved from a different country to America? And is that okay? And kind of this question of these core parts of people's identities, but that just because they're in some way related to race, we can't consider them. Or I remember Justice Jackson bringing up this hypothetical, right? Like a student that has five generations of parents that went to North Carolina versus a student who has been in North Carolina for five generations, but because they are descended from enslaved people, didn't have the chance to go to the school. Like, shouldn't you be able to consider both of those histories equally in letting them in? And that kind mm-hmm. of idea of how our past factors into admissions.
Yes, those are great examples of how deep the rabbit hole can get. And I think they demonstrate ultimately the futility of this idea of color blindness in a society that's still so permeated with racial consciousness at every level. So the idea that you could somehow set up artificially a process in which for this one decision, no one considers race and no one talks about it, but it permeates every other aspect of the person's life, and that that's somehow going to be equivalent to eliminating discrimination, that's a false promise. Because the example that you're pointing at, I've heard this discussed in the UC context. Do you redact things from people's admissions essays that mention race or that give it clues to their racial identity? Or do you instruct them that they can't write an essay about that? If you do either of those things, not only do I think that you're pretty close to a First Amendment violation, the Constitution is telling people they can't talk about something, but you're discriminating against them because race. So one person says, well, among the things that are most important to me and I can write a compelling essay about include my racial experience. Another person doesn't have that. Their experiences are different. The person whose life has been affected by race is told, you can't write about the things that are most important to you. Or if you do, we won't read it. We're going to redact it. I find it really hard to see that. In fact, I find it impossible to see that as anything other than discriminating against those people because of their race.
Yeah, and I think this whole conversation just makes clear how much the social and cultural perception of affirmative action has kind of warped the actual empirical and legal basis for it. People are just upset about race and about how much race impacts our society, and that seems very misguided. So what would you tell students, anyone, what should they understand about how we think about affirmative action's place in our culture now and in the past and moving forward?
Well, what I would say is that affirmative action is a quite mild policy that's designed to redress some of the effects of racial inequity and racial subordination in our society. It's not the most important one, and it's not anything close to a cure-all for the problems of racism. It makes a difference for some small set of people, the people who apply might be admitted to selective universities. It makes those universities better because it lets the universities have a student population that not only reflects our society, that's the diversity argument, but also I would argue a student population that's closer to their ideal because it lets them correct for racial disadvantages of the type we've been talking about that are pretty hard to identify directly, but for which race is a pretty good proxy. And finally, that it's important to note that the number of people that are admitted in underrepresented groups isn't very big. Even under affirmative action, it's not very big. And so the effect that affirmative action has on other people, people who aren't beneficiaries of an affirmative action preference, is quite small. And if people would look at that data and say, the effect on white and Asian applicants is negligible, the effect on Black and Latino applicants is significant, not huge, but significant, and the effect on society is maybe larger than one would think, given the outsized influence of selective universities, but all in a positive direction, that this is a policy that gets us some significant degree of improvement in race relations really on the cheap. I mean, it's compared to all of the other things that we would need to do in order to begin to remedy lingering race discrimination, deal with segregated neighborhoods and unequal K through 12 education and the prison system and policing. Those are all expensive and they're hard to do. Affirmative action's a guinea as compared to that. And admittedly, it's not everything, but it's something, and it's actually very sad that we would eliminate it.
Right. It's so easy and it's so straightforward and it's so simple and really almost has very few negative effects. Mm-hmm. And yet we've become hyper focused on eliminating it. That's just shocking. Yeah. Well, Professor Ford, thank you so much for talking with me. So lovely that you can come on the podcast. It's just been great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you too. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
No matter how much I think I already know about affirmative action, there's always more to learn, more viewpoints to consider, more perspectives to hear, and more angles to look at. We have so many more exciting episodes to come with amazing legal professors, advocates, and perhaps even admissions officers. While you're waiting, don't forget to leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com. We can't wait to see you next time.